after the distribution of the insignia came the Te Deum, at 3 o'clock the ceremony ended. The emperor was saluted by the artillery and returned to the Tuileries. No solemnity could have been more effective and suited to the times, more representative of the new order of things. None could have been more impressive in its simplicity, or have left deeper traces behind the army, the populace, the citizens, and the soldiers, all the men of whom the state was proud and who had done her good service, were gathered together that day with Napoleon at their head to celebrate and do honor to their country. The day, too, chosen for the ceremony was the anniversary of the 14th of July, which witnessed the passing away of the feudal system and the beginning of a new age. In a military uniform reminiscent of his victories, with his little hat upon his head, booted and spurred, ready to mount his horse for the defense of the work of the revolution, Napoleon was an appropriate and representative figure. He was not loaded with the obsolete and grandiose trappings by which he hoped to revive the tradition of a vanished age. He appeared as the foremost man of the modern age, unpretentious, yet full of youth and activity. In his train was military pomp, and around him were walls hung with the trophies of his glory. In him, the nation saluted the man whom she had delighted to honor, and whom she exalted in the place of a king whose divine right she had repudiated. On that day, the 26th of Messidor of the year 7, was inaugurated. Empire, such as the people and army had desired. Napoleon did not perceive all this. He had no sympathy with the modern grandeur of such ceremony. He did not consider the garb in which he had been clothed suited to the solemn taking of an oath. The pomp had not been sufficiently magnificent, nor the place sufficiently venerable, vast and imposing. The procession had seemed too small, and the ceremony had not displayed enough religious feeling. On the 27th, Portalis had well written to him, "When your majesty appeared, it seemed as though the patriotism of all was aroused. There was no longer a division between the friends and enemies of the commonwealth, but your presence awoke in each a sense of admiration, respect, and love." Yet he was not satisfied. His nature hankered after more foil and tinsel, a greater display, more of the past ages of Rome and Charlemagne, and a good deal more of royalty. The fitness of reality made no appeal to him. His imagination was inflamed with high-sounding illusions. The crowning of an emperor implied to him something that was not modern or contemporary, something to be expressed in a vaguely Roman form, with an admixture drawn from the Germanic ceremonies of the Second Dynasty, grafted on the usages of the hallowing of the French kings. As he was not yet certain of obtaining the presence of the chief actor whom he desired, he gave out that the ceremony would be almost entirely secular. But he had already determined on several of the pomps to be displayed and some of the rites which were to be performed 3 days after the distribution at the Invalides. On the 29th of Messidor, July 18th, he issued a decree regulating the dress to be worn by the emperor, the empress, the princess, the grand dignitaries, ministers, the members of the great state bodies, the marshals, the ladies, and the grand officers of the crown. He chose for himself a white tunic embroidered with gold, a purple velvet mantle powdered with golden bees, an open golden crown wrought in the likeness of laurel leaves, a golden scepter, a gold hand of justice, and a sword studded with diamonds at the hilt. The empress was to have a corresponding dress of white silk with a purple mantle. The princes and dignitaries were also to wear white tunics and flowing mantles, white for the former, varied colored for the latter. His train was to be composed of peers of France, or perhaps more accurately, German electors. However, he found on reflection that these costumes were too like his own and suppressed them. The decree was drawn up but not published. It's seemed as though he was merely playing with the idea and experimenting with the preparations without coming to any definite decision. At the end of his decree, it was announced that all details of the festival and ceremonies of the coronation would be settled later. In reality, he was awaiting the answer which the Pope would give to the advances and offers made to him. It was here that the chief Carlovingian element was to be introduced. Had not Pepin been consecrated by Pope Stephen III, who had come to implore his help against the Lombards? Had not Charlemagne been crowned at Rome by Leo III? When he was at Auxonne, Napoleon had read, transcribed, and annotated Mably. Perhaps this passage had struck him. The Pope also consecrated the sons of Pepin and called both them and their father the anointed of the Lord. Stephen's ideas were confused, and by comparing the position of Pepin to the royalty of David, a kind of priesthood against which the Jews could not rebel without committing sacrilege, he was applying the principles of a divine government founded upon miracles to the French sovereignty, which had long been abandoned by God to the common law of men. The Franks had just chosen Pepin of their own free will and without the command of any prophet sent from God, but the Pope told them that the prince held his crown from God alone through the intercession of Saints Peter and Paul, and threatened them with the anger of the church if they ever departed from the faith and obedience which they owed to Pepin and his descendants. Here, perhaps, instead of the democracy, was the foundation on which Napoleon wished to base his authority? Would it not be possible to have his power, if not divinely delegated, at least blessed with a divine consecration? Possibly. If he did not believe in such a thing for himself, he believed in it for his subjects, at least for some of them. He wasn't willing that his coronation should take place without any ritualistic service, yet he could hardly be consecrated by one of the bishops whom he had himself appointed. The Holy Emperor had been broken, and the Archbishop of Rheims, who had been turned out of his see by the Concordat, remained faithful in exile to his prescribed masters. It was impossible to renew the broken Capuchin tradition for the benefit of the new dynasty, but if Pius VII were to come to France to consecrate Napoleon as Stephen III had consecrated Pepin to Short and Stephen IV, Louis le Debonair, and the Vicar of Christ, were thus to recognize definitely the rupture between the church of which he was the chief and the descendants of the most Christian kings, and were himself to crown in the place of a son of St. Louis, the ruler chosen by the nation after the example of Pope Zachary's treatment of Childeric III, then the claims of Napoleon would perhaps be possessed of a legitimacy such as he had hoped vainly to get by the abdication of the pretender, and such as was not to be gained by a mere popular election. But Napoleon ought really to have considered whether his own gains by this arrangement would be equal to those of the Roman Church. First, he gained a divine institution for his dynasty, but there were not very many Catholics in France who believed in the actual interference of the Almighty in human politics. Besides, was such an institution desirable? If the Pope gave, could he not take away? Was he to have the disposition of the crown of France, the country which had witnessed the pragmatic sanction of the Concordat of Francis I, would not his presiding over the inauguration of the new dynasty be even more than the recognition of the bull in Cona Domini, and acknowledgement of the Pope's right to make and unmake the sovereigns of France? It was likely also that all those who, according to the religious freedom established by the constitutions, professed another faith or were open unbelievers, would be justly offended at the ruler of the state demanding and receiving an illegal institution which would have the effect of making the Catholic religion completely dominant. Secondly, his character would become sacred. Yet daggers had been raised against many the Lord's anointed, such as Henry III, IV, Louis XV, while the blade of the guillotine, which severed the head of Louis XVI, had destroyed at a blow the superstition of the royal immunity and the sacrilege of treason. Thirdly, the attainment of eternal peace and the final abolition of disturbances resulting from the constitutional schism. But the eminent bishops who had refused to submit to the Pope at the time of the Concordat were not likely to be appeased now by his consecration of Napoleon, and the constitutionals, who had formerly been willing to sign an instrument which protected their rights of conscience, would they not naturally be annoyed when, in order to appear before the Pope, they would be forced to deny the words and acts which had been prompted by their faith as Christians and their patriotism as Frenchmen? The Gallican liberties, which had been so proudly asserted by the First Consul and so shaken by the Concordat, would now be in a fair way of disappearing altogether when the head of the church showed himself in person to receive the veneration of the faithful and stir up the imagination of the rising generation of priests. Thus, Pius VII would appear as Supreme Pontiff. The revolution The Roman Church, on the other hand, would gain a most astonishing victory just as she had triumphed over the barbaric conquerors of the prostrate empire, imposing on them her customs, laws, observances, and even dress. So would she triumph over this new barbarian, the man of the revolution, and imposed on him her discipline and authority. By him, she would establish her domination for at least a century in France, which had been hitherto, though Christian, yet rebellious to the ultramontane teaching. In order to await the answer of the Pope, Napoleon sent Josephine to Aix-la-Chapelle on pretense of drinking the waters and prepared to follow her himself in order to visit the tomb and remains of Charlemagne. Perhaps he even thought that the Pope might consecrate him in that city of the Second Dynasty. Paris was not very much in his favor at that time. This town, he said, has always proved a misfortune to France. The citizens are fickle and ungrateful and have plotted deeply against me. In any case, at X in the neighborhood of Charlemagne, he redoubled his outward marks of veneration for his great predecessor. It was as though he was first demanding his institution at the hands of that famous emperor. On leaving X certain of a favorable answer, he wrote to the Pope, Pius VII, and begged him to come to Paris to consecrate and crown him emperor.